Play to Potential Podcast.
Welcome to the ninth conversation at the Play to Potential podcast series. My guest this time is Prakash Iyer. He's a best-selling author of two books, The Habit of Winning and The Secret of Leadership, and has one coming out soon. He's also a motivational speaker and a leadership coach. In his corporate career, he was last the MD of Kimberly-Clark Lever, and prior to that, he was the MD and CEO of Infomedia India Limited. Prior to that, he'd held leadership roles with PepsiCo in India and in China. He's an alumnus of IIM Ahmedabad and Hindustan Unilever, two of the most prominent leadership factories in the country. Without further ado, over to the conversation. Prakash, thanks for your time. Excited to be talking to you.
My pleasure entirely. Good to be here.
Before we dive in, Prakash, would love to get a sense of what your pie chart, again, pun intended, looks like. What all do you do, and give us a sense of what your day looks like.
What all do I do? Essentially, I have lots of fun.
Okay.
And on a more serious level, perhaps try and help other people become as good as they can be. Uh-huh. And what that often entails is, you know, maybe three or four things. So I'm a leadership coach. So I work with individuals and teams around coaching. I do a fair bit of speaking. Uh-huh. Motivational sessions, keynotes around leadership, teams, winning. Uh-huh. And that's something I enjoy a love a lot. I try and write a bit. So just done with a third book and hopefully another one. It's always in the works. So there's hopefully another one coming out soon too.
Wow. You mean two in the bag and two more to go, or one more to go?
Two in the bag, three this month.
Okay.
And hopefully lots more to go.
Oh,
yeah.
I'm sure.
Yeah.
True.
So there are ideas buzzing in my head all the time, and I'm thinking, hey, I would love to write a lot more, and it's something I enjoy. So I'd certainly like to write a lot more. I also do some advisory work with a private equity fund.
Got it.
That broadly covers the spectrum of what I do.
Got it. Again, maybe a good place to start, Prakash, is you're an alumnus of IIMA as well, and you were in a corporate career for a while. At some stage, you moved on and you've gotten to this portfolio life. Give us a sense of why you do what you do and how you got here.
I guess I just enjoy doing what I'm doing right now.
Uh-huh.
It gives me a great thrill. You know, when I wrote my first book, this was 2010.
This was The Habit of Winning.
It was The Habit of Winning. That's right. I don't think there are too many other things in my life that would have compared with the sense of joy that I felt mm-hmm. when I held that book in my hand. And you know, the interesting bit is that that book could have been a dud. It could have, no one may have read it, or people may have read it and panned it. Yet for that moment, I felt very good. Mm-hmm. And then of course, when the book did well, it kind of changed a lot of things for me. I really enjoyed that bit. And I enjoy speaking to people. This gives me my high, as it were. And therefore, that's really why I do what I'm doing. And I think it's a sense of saying that I enjoy it. I'm passionate about it. I think I can do it reasonably well.
Sure.
I may not be terrific at it, but I'm reasonably good at it, I think. And that gives me a sweet spot in that sense. You say, I'm doing what I like. I think I'm doing something I can do reasonably well. And hey, if it all means I can make a difference, kind of works well for me.
Lovely. And just going back to that moment where you spoke about writing the book and holding a copy in hand, was that when you were pursuing your career, or you sort of moved on and then sat down and wrote the book?
No, so I was very much in a career when I wrote the book.
Okay.
I must tell you this, that, you know, every year I write my list of things to do for the year.
Uh-huh.
And it's one of those things that I still have a lot of the older versions of my wish list.
And it's impressive that you're tracking it. Most of the times it's...
What is impressive is I'm tracking it. What is not so impressive is that many of them are still work in progress.
Got it.
So, you know, having a golf handicap under 16, still work in progress. Having a waist size back to 32, still work in progress. But that hasn't taken away from the fact that there were things there which have come good.
Mm-hmm.
And writing a book has certainly been one of those things which has been on that list for a while. And then I started blogging, mm-hmm. and really that blog then paved the way for the book.
Mm.
And like I said, it's been one of the better things that I might have done in this.
And just building on that, Prakash, I talk to a lot of people who've decided to move away from a corporate life, which is aligning yourself with one company and building your career there as a platform.
versus people who've cobbled together a portfolio of different things. For example, you do a combination of speaking, writing, coaching, and a bunch of other things. What's been that journey like? It's been how many years now? It's been 6 years of this sort of portfolio life, if I may call
it. Less. 3 years now.
3 years?
3 years.
So again, any wisdom, any insights on what this journey looks like, what the highs and lows are for people at the cusp of making the decision?
I think the first bit would have to be the fact that you've got to enjoy what you're doing and not constantly look at what that other world or the other life might look like. So if I was to be honest, I spent 30 years in a regular corporate job, but pretty much loved every moment of it.
Sure.
I don't think there were too many times in my life where I felt like, hey, why am I doing this? And I want to be doing something else. I don't think that's how it was.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe the driving force was different. So, you know, when I went to work in my early days, I guess there was a pure commercial reason. You had to put food on the table. You know, you had a wife to look after, kids to kind of bring up. So you needed money. And a good corporate job, I think, took care of that. But I think I also learned a hell of a lot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of the stories that I now tell, a lot of the lessons that I now share, I think come out of the years that I might have spent at work.
Sure.
So I don't think it's a case of saying that I was always longing to do sure. this new thing. I think I kind of worked towards it. I had spent 30 years working with teams and learning a hell of a lot, hopefully doing a little bit for the businesses that I might have been involved with. And that set me up, I think, for what I do now.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm building on it and clearly doing something that I really enjoy doing and think, wow, this is really what I want to do for the rest of my life.
And got it. And just to make it real, what are the lows in such a path, right? Again,
sure.
I've sort of embarked on this. It's been a year. And I have my share of highs and lows. But uh-huh. I'm curious about 3 years in, for some, just to make it real, because I believe when people are at a point of transition, there's always the greener side of the grass is always painted with a lot of color.
Mm.
But the not so green side doesn't get spoken about as much. So if you were to be honest, what have the lows been like for you?
I think one of the clear challenges can be the fact that you don't actually get to work with a terrific bunch of people on a regular basis.
Right.
And therefore, that can be fairly stimulating while it's there.
Mm.
And when it goes away, it can become a bit of a challenge. So I certainly miss that.
Mm.
The fact that I might have had some fantastic conversations with colleagues and friends at work.
Right.
You still might meet interesting people. You might have something to, you know, you might have interesting conversations, but they're not quite the same level of intensity and depth.
Right.
As you might have had with a bunch of very bright colleagues. To be fair, working with bright colleagues also sharpens
sure.
all of us as individuals. And I
sure.
think that's something that I probably miss a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
There are days when, you know, when you can probably start thinking, hey, what do you do? Why am I doing what I'm doing? And there could be days where you'll feel a bit down mm-hmm. and, you know, and that often coincides with that call that you'll get from another headhunter who says, you know, he thinks it's time for you to get back. But I think if you're clear about why you're doing what you're doing,
mm.
and if you have the right reasons for doing it,
mm.
I think it can become fairly interesting in itself. There's something else that I think you need to probably have a good answer for, which is, you know, what do you do is a question that you get asked.
Mm.
And I must confess, after 3 years, I still struggle with that a little bit.
Sort of the identity question, right?
The identity, yeah. And therefore, I think it's an important one that you've got to be willing to say that, you know, that whatever you say doesn't matter.
Hmm.
And whatever somebody else might think doesn't matter.
Right.
Because if it matters to you, then you're probably not ready to make that shift.
Very interesting.
So it might be a good idea for you to check. And I used to say this earlier, that are you willing to have a business card which doesn't have a company name on it? And, you know, many hmm. of us grew up with, you know, being proud to quickly exchange cards on a flight. And the other person looked at it, then, you know, suddenly sat up and took renewed interest in who you were because of the name of that business that you represented.
Hmm.
I think it's a good idea to have to be able to say that you work for this unknown company called Prakash Iyer and Co.
Hmm.
And then what happens? Do people kind of still want to talk to you?
Fascinating. Actually, that sort of brings up the point around personal brand building. I want to get to that in a couple of minutes.
Mm-hmm.
But before that, you touched upon storytelling. Right, and that's something that I've always been passionate about in terms of how do we inculcate that skill. And the reason I mention it is I sort of grew up in the school of brevity. As a consultant, you're always told,
yeah.
get to the point, start with the answer first, the whole pyramid principle, here's the answer, and by the way, here's how we got there. and almost pushes you in the other direction, where you start valuing people's time and so on and so forth, which is logically great. But somewhere I realized that to touch an emotion or to build a connect, stories are powerful. So one is, two questions here actually. One is, I'd be curious on your take on how do you think about the trade-off here? Is there a trade-off at all? And how do you think about it is number one. And number two, how do people build the muscles? I mean, you're a great storyteller. You do it in your books, you do it in your speeches. But how does the aam aadmi build the storytelling muscle? What are some of the lessons? What do you do, and what are some of the lessons you've learned?
Yeah, sure. So the first question first. It's a mistake to think that there's a trade-off between having a coherent, logical approach to an argument versus telling a story.
Hmm.
I think in an ideal scenario, you have fairly sound logic and a coherent argument to make. But if you just stayed with the logic, you'd probably not be as effective as if you were able to wrap this around in a story.
Hmm.
Okay. So a great story without the logic being right won't really be, terribly powerful. I think the mistake people make is to think just a story would do.
Correct.
And the mistake that a lot of consultants might make, could be to believe that, we're really here. It's, cut to the chase, and here's what the story is all about. Here's what the meat
the
is.
The messages, yeah.
Here's what the message is. Here's the logic. I think the point is that we are, we all like logic, but we don't always buy it. We are all emotional at one level. We want to remember. We want to be told in a nice way. And I think stories have this ability to connect a lot better.
Mm-hmm.
Stories are also very powerful in terms of just being able to retain the message, to be more memorable.
Mm-hmm.
I think stories can go a long way in helping. Stories are also a good way to kind of make messages more palatable.
Mm-hmm.
Very often what happens is, if you tell someone you are like this and this is the problem with your business or this is what you need to do, you're constantly trying to be on the back foot defending your business, defending yourself.
Hmm.
But if you can move this to a story about another world, another place, suddenly you've got my interest and my buy-in.
Got it.
And I can now see what's happening out there. And maybe the message now gets in that what worked for them might work for me. And I'm more willing to kind of take it.
Fascinating. It's almost like transport people to a parallel world and then distill lessons back and apply it back to the situation at hand.
See, it takes a consultant to then be able to say it right. Thanks, yeah.
Can't tell stories, but I can sort of paraphrase stories.
Yeah.
And the other question, Prakash, which is about how do you get people to be good storytellers? What do you do, and what's been your experience in enabling others to be good storytellers?
So I think there's a storyteller inside each of us.
Right.
We all love to tell stories. So I guess the first bit would be for us as leaders to recognize that, hey, there is a story that I'd like to tell, and maybe it's an effective way to get my message across.
Mm-hmm.
I then try and tell leaders that there are, 5 or 6 stories that leaders must learn to tell.
Mm-hmm.
And the truth is that stories are all around us.
Sure.
You just need to look. And leaders themselves are often surprised when they start looking. There are so many stories that they find. And then I help them with the idea that once you have the story, don't worry too much about, how to tell the story or how to craft the story. That's the easy bit. The real positive in all this is really the fantastic stories that are around waiting to be told.
Hmm.
And once a leader gets his or her hands around that story, the rest becomes fairly easy. And I think leaders then start enjoying it. And then they discover that, what started off as 1, 2, and 3 stories suddenly has become 5 and 10. And that works well in an organizational context, I think.
And actually, just to persist with that, again, I've heard a lot of people talk about the role of storytelling in building culture, right? And a lot of organizations use that in a pretty effective mm-hmm. way. And one of my friends was telling me, actually, CSO now stands for
Storytelling Officer.
Storytelling Officer, not Chief Strategy Officer anymore.
Yeah.
So what's been your experience in the role of stories in, let's say, building a culture in a company?
Yeah.
I would love your perspectives.
I think organizations are now discovering something that employees always knew.
Hmm.
So if you think about it, if you were in a canteen, what's the water cooler gossip all about? It's about stories. So employees have been telling each other stories for years. If you look at how do people think of their bosses, they tell stories. How do you think of what the organization is all about? They tell stories. What leaders can now do is to try and say, hey, how can we ensure that we have the right kind of stories that are being shared?
Right.
And if you don't share the stories, people will find their own stories in any case. Hmm. So what storytelling can do from a culture building perspective is to try and make culture come alive, to try and sensitize people to what this place is really all about. And I think if leaders learn to tell those stories, they'll figure that they can use storytelling to dramatically alter what culture looks like in that place, to also make culture come alive. Hmm. You know, I like it that, you know, great leaders, what they do is they find other people who are doing the things that the culture of this business is all about, and then they tell stories about it.
Got it.
And at another level, what they do is to do those things which their culture is supposed to be all about, and then tell the world about it.
Got it.
In both cases, it's first making sure somebody's doing it and then talking about it. And that's really what stories can do.
Got it. Very interesting. I was talking to, back to your point about everyday observation, one of my earlier guests was a stand-up comedian called Papa CJ.
Mm-hmm. Great guy.
Lovely guy. And as we were exploring the conversation, I realized that a lot of stand-up actually, when one thinks about it, is actually about stories around daily life. It's about the small irritant and sort of trying to do a story around it or a joke around it, which is about really having that keen eye for detail, but coupled with the ability to sort of share it with a wider group in a compelling way.
So,
I want to move back to the other point you made, Prakash, about having a business card with no logo but just your name, which brings us to the point around personal branding again, and to compound that with all the stuff that's happening in the digital world. Again, what's been your journey on that front? How have you thought about it? And again, if there were some nuggets you want to share with the listeners on how should people think about a brand? Again, if you were to wear a marketer's hat, I haven't spent time in a marketing organization, but would really value your perspectives on how you think about a brand in a company context and how you've thought about that in building your personal brand.
Mm. I think that's an interesting thought. What works for brands in a product sense, I think will work equally well with individuals.
Hmm.
And maybe there are two or three lessons that come to mind as I think of what can individuals learn,
right,
let's say from a more conventional product marketing perspective.
Right.
I think the first is the brand's got to be true to itself.
Hmm.
Brands can't be pretenders. I think consumers will see through them very, very quickly.
Hmm.
And that's, I think, a very fundamental rule, even for individuals looking to kind of set off on their own, or trying to build brands out of themselves. I think it's important to be honest.
Hmm.
So that level of integrity, honesty for a brand, I think clearly is paramount. The second perhaps is to try and remember what good brands do well is to look at themselves from a consumer standpoint, not from a manufacturer standpoint.
Hmm.
And I think a lot of individuals who try and get into advisory, consulting, gig economy kind of roles can start thinking, you know, my experience, my background, my credentials, here's what I can do, which is a very manufacturer standpoint.
Very interesting.
And I think it's an important one for us to be able to look at it from a consumer standpoint. How do I change? What value can I add for you? Mm. What does this mean for you? You know, a good question a brand will answer is, why should a consumer buy me? Mm. And therefore, to be mindful that you're not constantly looking at your portfolio of services and offerings from a manufacturer standpoint, but from a consumer standpoint.
So the outside in versus the inside out kind of a...
Pretty much that, yeah. So, you know, I think we've got to be careful that we don't keep looking at ourselves in the mirror and say, look, everybody, look how pretty I am. I think that won't take you too far. But if you can actually look out and say, hey, let me try and understand what's happening out there and how do they see me?
Hmm.
You know, how does the consumer look at me rather than saying, what's my view of the whole world? I think that can make a difference.
And in the early days, how does that feedback loop work? Let's say if I'm an individual who's set out on that journey, what's been your approach in seeking that feedback? Is it just sensing the pulse, or is it more explicit conversations with people to get a sense of what they see in you?
I think it's a bit of having those conversations, but more importantly, it's about having the right mindset.
Hmm.
I think you can get too keen on telling the world how smart you are, how you have all the answers. And therefore, this desire to kind of walk around with that hammer in your hand, waiting for everything you see as a nail, And you don't want to be there. You probably want to go out there and look around and see, ask questions, listen in, and try and get a sense of what is it that's happening out there. And then be willing to say, actually, I don't know, or, you know, I don't have the answer. I think the minute you do that, if you're willing to say, I don't have the answer for a few questions, you will discover you have very powerful answers to some other questions. And that's really where your sweet spot will be. And which brings me actually to the third bit that brands do well and individuals could learn from, which is, brands don't try and be all things to all people. Brands don't try and serve necessarily the lowest common denominator. Brands have something distinctive about them. Brands try and build on that difference, a distinctive difference, which appeals to some people and by definition will not appeal to some people. And brands are comfortable with that. Any brand which tries to say, I want to also win the other people in the market out there.
It's about saying no to a few things and choosing who your audience is, I guess.
That's right. And I think if you can say no to a few things, your yes suddenly becomes a little more interesting. When you say yes to everything, no one believes you anyways.
Got it. Fascinating. Moving topics, Prakash, again, in your books, one of your books, I think the foreword was written by Rahul Dravid. Clearly, there's a lot of cricket in your blood and in your books.
A lot of Dravid in me too. I love the guy.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of not just his game, but who he is as an individual. Very inspiring. I want to sort of see if we can learn from the game in the context of coaching specifically, which is one of the things you do. One of the pieces that companies often don't spend enough time on is how they should go about selecting a coach. Often they decide that somebody needs a coach, but the how piece is often left relatively unresolved, shall we say. So what's been, given you've been an observer of cricket, and we're talking at the end of a day where India won the second test match against Australia, so it's a good day to bring this up. What's been your observation in terms of how sports teams, specifically cricket teams, select coaches and the ones that have made a difference? And are there any lessons that can be learned in the corporate world on the selection of coaches specific to a situation?
Interesting one. I think there are two or three things that teams do as they start looking at coaches. And there are some lessons in what they also make sure they don't focus too much on in that search for the right coach. I think it helps to ensure that the coach has had familiarity with the environment that he will be in. And therefore, it's important to have played the sport at a reasonable level of proficiency. That's important. So it's not about how many runs you've scored in test cricket or how many hundreds you have or whether you have the highest now. But it's important that you've actually been in a scheme of things where you wake up in the morning, there's a test match, there's a game to be saved. You understand what it means to lose. You understand what it means to be hit out of the park. So you've been there. I think that level of familiarity and experience, I think, is important. I think they also look for some levels of proven credentials in this ability to coach. A mistake that corporates sometimes make with coaches and cricket teams seldom do is to believe that someone who scored a lot of runs will automatically make for a great coach.
Exactly. That's a great point you make.
And that's something that I think teams have figured pretty quickly. So teams want a coach who's been there at the highest level. But once you tick that box, it's not about how many runs you've scored. And it's not about saying, oh, he's been such a good batsman, let's get him as the coach. And I think some level of formal training helps. So I think a lot of coaches that you see around today have got formally trained in becoming level one, level two, level three coaches. So there is, apart from understanding the psychology of sport or the psychology of a batsman or a cricketer, you also understand what does it take to coach somebody. What can you teach? How do you train? What are some of the tools, some of the techniques that you can use? And I think that's something, again, that corporates would do well to perhaps look at. So you might get tempted by the fact that someone seems to be the kind of right kind of guy. And why is he a good coach? Because, you know he's very good with people. But that is not necessarily a sufficient condition to say that this person will make for a great coach. So some level of formal qualification / training / familiarity with tools and techniques, I think, can help. And the third thing I think that cricket teams do very, very well is to look for references. They want to know, you know, so you might be coming in to coach a team today, but they want to know, you know, weren't you second level coach for the New South Wales team? Hmm. How do you do there? And then didn't you spend a summer working with the Middlesex second 11?
Got it.
How did that go? Hmm. You know, how did that team do? And then you try and say, hey, is there somebody in that team we can reach out to just get a sense of what was it like to have this person in the dressing room? I think that level of diligence is useful. And I think I'd urge corporates to also perhaps do that as they look at a coach and not get swayed by reputation. I think it's tempting to think that, oh, he's such a big, you know, he was such a big person or she was such a big name in the corporate world. So we've got that person as a coach. Wow, we've got a big win here. You know, the big win, the euphoria will last for the first few hours before you get that person in. After that, it's about how effective is that coach in working with a coachee.
Just picking up on the previous point, Prakash, about a good player does not necessarily translate to being a good coach. Similarly, from a captaincy perspective, and again, I say this in the context of companies selecting CEOs. Once again, we've had some great batsmen or bowlers, and the debate has been around, do we want them as a batsman or do we want to lose the batsman to being a captain? What are the lessons, once again, on how companies should think about leadership in terms of appointing the CEO? Any lessons from the sports world that can be transported in terms of the mistakes that one should avoid?
I think you alluded to that, which is, you know, India's finest batsman didn't really make for a great captain. And I think it's not a bad thing.
Right.
Not everybody was meant to be a great captain. And sometimes you could have talent which is so precious and so very useful in its primary role that you don't want to burden that with the pressures of captaincy and leadership. So I think corporates need to be careful that they just don't just pick out the best performer, the best performing individual to be the leader, and that they actually look for leadership skills. That's one lesson. But the flip side of that lesson is also true, which is I think leaders still need to pull their weight in the team. You know, and Mike Brearley might have been a great idea for an England team once upon a time, but I don't think the idea would work today. You still need to be able to command your place in the team, and that will make you an effective leader. And I think it maybe Brearley was special. I think he was a professor of psychology and a student of the game at some level. So he probably had this ability to transcend his own performance and yet lead people. But that's not easy. And we've often seen how great leaders in the sporting in a sporting context struggle to assert their authority because their personal form is letting them down. Their personal contribution is not keeping pace. And I think that's something that corporates need to be careful about too. But you might think somebody's got terrific leadership skills or might be a good leader and might have been there in the helm for a long time. But if he or she is not, you know, if they're not pulling their weight on their own, they may not, it may be time for a leadership change.
Interesting. So it's not just about being an orchestra conductor, but there's also a role of playing an instrument as part of the orchestra, which makes it interesting.
I think that's where the captaincy bit comes in. The coach is probably a bit of that conductor of the orchestra.
Got it.
But the coach has got to, the captain's got to be playing one of those instruments
out there. Exactly, while keeping the eye on the others. Right?
That's right.
Very interesting. I want to change the frame a little bit. It's been about three decades plus since you passed out of IMA. And again, when I rewind the clock, where I was at that point in time and how I thought about careers or some of my batchmates thought about careers, it was largely, to put it bluntly, it was an auction, right? I think in a lot of cases, a lot of us didn't have a clear framework on what next. But again, having been through a bunch of experiences now, I think there's greater clarity. So I think if you, with the wisdom of whatever you've learned in the 30 years, if you were to visit that point in time, March 1986 or whenever that was, anything you would have done differently? How would you have thought about careers at that point in time with what you've been through?
I'd probably have wished that this phrase called investment banking had been created by the time when I was graduating from business school, but that didn't exist then. But I think on a more serious note, I don't think it was really the auction element in that sense. Sure, all of us were worried about getting a day one job and a day two job, and all of that. But I still think I had friends and who made decisions which were as much to do with the quality of the work or the challenge that they thought they would get at the, in the roles they were going to be performing. Speaking for myself, I had a job with a bank and with a consumer products company.
Right.
And no prizes for guessing that the bank would have been paying me a lot more money, but you know, I didn't take it.
And what swung the needle for you?
I guess the fact that I could see heroes in my life who were in the consumer product space, and it's a world that I used to fantasize about. So this whole idea of being able to go and sell soap and you know, and be the man who next created the girl in the waterfall for a soap brand seemed like such an exciting idea as compared to the boring job of counting money in a bank, you know. So I guess there are no right answers in these things, but it's just a matter of saying that, you know, are you willing? I think what the education out there would probably have done for all of us is to give us the confidence and the courage to take those calls. And I think that's just got stronger over time. And perhaps if you ask me, one of the good things that's happened to the generation that's followed, as I see my own children today, I think their ability to take risks, their ability to chase their dreams, to do stuff which they just think they want to do and not because of the price tag attached to that task. I think that's a very liberating feeling. And it, I think, enables excellence. It probably gives everyone a chance to be the best they can be.
True.
Because they're really doing stuff that they want to do.
Got it. Since you pursued a consumer goods path, you joined Unilever out of campus.
That's right.
Hindustan
Lever in those days.
Any insights on how the questions people should ask themselves for them to determine if a path down that road would make sense? Consumer goods, if I may use a broader term. And the reason I ask is, as we grow through life, we have a lot more data on what energizes us, and we've been through enough situations for us to have, let's say, big data on ourselves. But at that stage, we are operating with very limited data. So are there one or two key questions? If you look at people that joined the consumer goods, let's say, path, and people that dropped off at some point in time, is there any pattern that emerges in terms of what did not work out for them?
I used to think that the industry specific is not such a big variable. And if you find the work that you enjoy and the challenges that you have, then the product could be be different. So whether it was a consumer product or industrial one or a financial services product may not have been a difference. But having said that, the reality is that there is a difference. And I do remember how, you know, if you decided to go and sell soap, you then end up, you know, being in small town India, going across to rural markets, which is not everybody's idea of a great life. And not everyone says, I went to the one of the better business schools in this country, to then go to places where, you know, where the good life isn't really there. And so you suddenly say that, you know, there are friends of yours who are saying, oh, you know what, I was passing through Singapore when I met this other friend of ours who was going to do this deal in Hong Kong. And, you know, we were hoping to catch up in London. And you're saying, yeah, but you know, as I went from Jalpaiguri to Asansol, you know, life was very different. So are you comfortable with the idea? If you are, then hey, I think consumer products is for you. If you're comfortable with the idea of being able to talk to a distributor in a language you don't understand and trying to convince him to buy some more soap, because you know that eventually that's also, you know, something that will come be of use to you in your career.
Sure.
If you're good with that, consumer products might be for you. But if you're not, and if you're really looking at other things in life, then maybe you're cut out for other stuff. But I'd still say this, that you could be in another business, but you still need to understand your customer. You still need to spend time with your customer. You still need to be willing to do the hard yards, do the dirty work, do the small stuff, because that will then equip you when your turn comes to play the role of a leader. There are no shortcuts, and I don't think it's a great idea to take a double promotion and say, you know what, I don't want to do the tough bit first. I'll just go and become a leader straight away. That won't work. You can choose your industry segment, but you can't choose. Hard work isn't an option, I think.
Very interesting. That's an interesting way to put it, to say it's less to do with the industry, but more to do with the roles and the different stints and sort of character building, for lack of a better term, through those stints, which equip you in the future. The other piece that I find helpful reflecting on, Prakash, is just how people set their goalpost as they go through the journey. Again, if you take stock of the last three decades, how's that formed and moved over time? Have there been discrete points in time where it's shifted significantly? I'd love your perspectives on how you think about that.
I'd probably say this, that as some, you know, like a lot of other kids coming out of middle class India, financial goals were important in the early stage of, in the early stages of our lives. And therefore, you know, it was important for you to kind of make enough bread and butter and some jam. But beyond that, I guess I've been swayed by this guy. You know, there's this interesting story of how Joseph Heller apparently was at this party thrown by an investment banker in New York.
This is the guy who wrote Catch 22.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah.
And Joseph Heller was, you know, but a friend of his took him along and said, come, it's a great party. You'll meet all the who's who of the city. And as he went there, it was a great evening, lots of crystal, the finest wine. And as Joseph Heller stood sipping a drink, his friend said, you know, do you realize that our host, the investment banker, probably makes more money in a day than you do than you have in a lifetime? And Joseph Heller said, you know, that's probably true. But you know something? I have something he'll never have. And the friend says, what? And Joseph Heller says, enough. And that's a story that's kind of stayed with me. And in a sense, I think I spent the last few years of my life saying, hey, I think I need to learn to say enough. And the minute I know I have enough, you're sorted.
Right.
You don't really need to worry about it. And then you're free to go and do what you want to do. So to be fair, financial goals were important. But I'd probably say I hit that at some stage. I said enough. And then it doesn't excite you. More of the same didn't excite me. And what really excited me was, you know, the euphoria, the fun of going out and, you know, either writing something which people will read or saying something which people will listen to and say, wow, that made a difference to my life. That for me was a big turn on.
Got
so
it.
To me, the goals changed in that sense from the first maybe 15, 20 years of my life to perhaps what I do now.
Very interesting. And just maybe staying with that theme, one is sort of having clarity on, as they say, how much you need versus how much you want, right? And knowing what that enough point is. But having crossed that bridge, how do you think about impact or how do you think about success? Are there a few things that you think about against which you say, okay, that was a fulfilling year or a fulfilling, passage of play over a period of time? Do you think about that?
I do. And I'd be lying if I said I don't think about it. And I probably want to, you know, connect this to a set of earlier questions you asked, which is how do you recognize whether this is something that you should be doing or
right. How
do you find that little thing that says, yep, this is really what my calling in life is going to be. And I like to think of this as that, you know, as that Venn diagram, you know, it's got those three circles. The first is really your passion. What are you passionate about?
Right.
And you've got to really be saying, what is it that, you know, really excites you, gets you out of your bed and you'd want to be doing for the rest of your life. And that's really what you're passionate about. And that comes with another circle, which is really, what are you really good at? And, you know, do you get a chance to do stuff where people say, wow, you know what? You do this really well, or you're particularly good at it. So what are you distinctively, uniquely good at? So I think those two circles need to intersect. And then you have a third, which is really what adds value. And I think that's an important piece because it's not enough to say, I do what I enjoy and I'm pretty good at it.
That's
because if people don't value it, then clearly something is missing.
That's where the commercial case sometimes kicks in, right?
And therefore, there has to be a commercial case. Now, you could argue that, you know what, you really don't need the money. There is value. You may not take it.
Yeah.
And you might decide to do something else. You might want to change the world. You might want to work with another, you know, with parts of a society which can't afford it, which is all terrific. But there is value and real value that's being created. So I think it's important to have these three circles intersecting. Passion, strengths, value. And I think the intersection of these three is really your sweet spot.
Yep.
And I keep telling myself that, you know, in everything that I do, that it's important to be ensuring that value circle is also coming into it.
Got it.
People must value it. And I've also recognized that if they don't value it, you know what? No one's going to take you seriously.
Right.
And you're probably not doing justice to your strengths. And you're probably not doing as much as you can if people don't value it enough. And for me, value can also be, you know, in the early days when I wrote my first book, I still remember I got this email from someone saying, you know, I'm sitting in my engineering lab in Varanasi. And until today, I used to be cursing my parents for sending me here. And I've just finished reading your book. And I'm telling myself, you know what? It's not their fault. I'm responsible for what's happening in my life. And thank you for kind of blah, 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 making a difference. And I just think, wow, here is someone I've never met, probably never will meet. But if I have managed to kind of, you know, get a switch to get turned on in his head, you know, it's been worth my while.
Wonderful. Powerful. And again, picking up on this journey so far, 30 plus years, and sort of again, reflecting on some of the other journeys that some of your friends and batchmates and colleagues have been through, Any back to your point about, you spoke about your the children of this generation being a lot more open to the idea of pursuing the passion. What do you think are the bottlenecks that come in the way, especially when we think about people who've been 20 years in, 30 years in, when you look around, when you look at some of the people who are doing well, but maybe not performing to the potential, in your mind, where do the bottlenecks lie of untapped potential, if you will, in other people's journeys? What's, again, do you have some themes that come up?
Two possibly recurring themes. The first, I think, is a reluctance to slog, a reluctance to put in the hard yards. So I think a lot of great talent goes to waste because it's not willing to kind of work hard. And therefore, just realizing that, you know what, I could be passionate about something, I could be talented, but I still need to work hard. I still need to put in, you know, the long hours. There are no shortcuts to that one. I think that's probably one common theme. The second for me would be, when you're talented and passionate, you tend to think of yourself as a lone ranger. And I think that can sometimes become limiting. You need to recognize that, you know, even a slightly less talented person, but with a stronger support staff, will probably go a longer way. And therefore, the ability to enlist other people into your journey, the ability to excite other people to help you in your journey, the ability to get other people to get onto your bus and say, this is our bus, let's take it to a great place. I think that can help talent and passion reach heights that otherwise may not have been possible on their own. Yeah. So teams and hard work, I think, would be the two things that I'd probably say.
Got it. To get right. Lovely. Just wrapping up, a couple of quick questions, Prakash. One is, in your opinion, three things they don't teach at IMA, at B school, let me put it that way. IMA, because we went there, but in general, three things they don't teach at B school, which...
So it's been a while since I left business school, and I'm guessing since you left business
school. Somewhere along the way too. I left, yeah.
Yeah, but I'm guessing that they still don't really... I think they don't teach you enough formally around the whole area of being a better leader. I think they teach you with a lot of the tools that it takes to make a to get it right for a business, to manage a business, but to be a leader, I think they could probably do a lot more around helping people to be better leaders. I'd love to see a course on failure in a B school.
Very interesting.
I think there's just too much of a premium placed on getting it right, on winning, on succeeding, and not enough around saying, you know, making mistakes, not being good enough, being clumsy, trying and failing. I think if they could teach us a little bit more of that, and if the next batch of students coming out was a little better at it, I think they'd be far more willing to take risks. The third one, I think, is that I'd love to see to see business schools get a little bit more outside of the academic piece into perhaps a more health and wellness space. I think the biggest challenge for many young people today and for their long-term success is their own health, is their own inability to keep pace. And therefore, learning to play a sport, learning to kind of stay fit, learning to watch your weight, learning to have healthy habits, I think can be a big differentiator in you know, if you consider that your career is really going to be a marathon.
Sure.
Just being able to stay the course, I think, is going to be an important one.
Very interesting. And actually, I used to train with a group of runners called Striders. And one of the things that trainers would say is the only variable you need to watch out for is the pace at which you run. Everything else falls in place, right? Wow. If that's out of sync with your body,
wow.
And everybody has their own pace. And if that's out of sync, you will be huffing and puffing somewhere.
Sure.
If you're running the half marathon, maybe not Worli Sea Phase, but at Pedder Road, it will catch up with you.
Great story. Yeah. So great point.
It's an interesting metaphor that stuck with me. In summary, Prakash, this podcast series is titled Play to Potential, which is about individuals discovering what they have potential for and playing the best game. We've spoken about a bunch of things, but two, three things you want to leave the listeners with for people to play to their potential?
So it's So if you want to play to your potential, I'd like to submit that you should have a PhD. And for me, that's a recurring theme for people who play to their potential, people who seem to get it right, people who seem to be able to do a lot more than might have looked possible. I think they all have a PhD. And for me, the PhD is really about those three things. The P is for the passion. I think you got to be passionate about what you do. You've got to be excited about what you do. You've got to really love what you do. I think time is too short to be wasted on doing things you don't enjoy doing. So passion, extremely important. I think that passion's got to be backed with hunger. You must be hungry for success. You must be hungry for more. And I think one of the challenges for this generation can be the fact that they are not hungry. They are passionate, but the hunger isn't there. And you'll see that when you look at people who achieve, people who kind of make a difference to this world, they are people who are hungry for more. You know, and I know outsourcing has been quite a fad in all these years, but hunger still can't be outsourced to someone else. I think you've got to feel it for yourself. You've got to want it badly. And I think that's the, therefore passion, there's hunger. And that brings me to the D, and that's discipline. I think you can be passionate and hungry, but if you don't have the discipline to kind of see it through, you won't really achieve very much. And I think you've got to have the discipline to stick with it, to do it when it's not comfortable, to do it when the odds are stacked against you, to keep running along when you see hurdles on the way and you say, hey, you know what, I'll find another way. You know, I love the story of a gymnast who was apparently, you know, she won a silver, and when they asked her how she did it, she said, simple, I practiced when I felt like it, and I practiced when I didn't feel like it. You know, the good news is most of us are halfway to winning a medal because we do things when we feel like it.
It's like the Sholay coin toss. Right?
It's a bit like the Sholay coin toss, yeah. So I think if you can get yourself that PhD, be passionate, be hungry, be disciplined, I think you'll give yourself a chance, you know, to play to your potential. And you know what? You owe it to yourself. I think each of us owes it to ourselves to play to our potential, because it's such a waste to see that potential not being utilized. So I think we owe it to ourselves. We owe it to the world at large to play to our potential.
That's a wonderful way of wrapping up the chat, Prakash. Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for having me here. I've enjoyed this too, Deepak. Thanks.
PhD is an interesting way of framing how one could tap one's potential. If we really think about it, passion gives you direction, hunger gives you momentum, and discipline ensures that you stay the course over the long term. Hope you found this conversation purposeful. For more, please visit audioboom.com and look for Play to Potential. Thank you for listening. Bye now.